And our New Zealand biography subject today is trade unionist and communist Bill Anderson, a very influential union leader in the 1950s and 1960s, fighting for workers' rights, but also fighting against racism. And he was a passionate pacifist too. With me to talk about his life and work is historian Sibel Locke, who is also Bill's biographer. Hi, Sibel.
Kia ora, Jesse. How are you?
Great. Kia ora. Nice to have you in.
Thank you.
Normally we'd just start with a bit of early life stuff, but I imagine a few people listening won't have heard of Bill Anderson, so would you like to give us a bit of an overview of his importance in New Zealand history?
Well, I think that those people who are in their mid-40s and over will have definitely heard of Gordon Harold Anderson, better known as a Bill Anderson. But yes, you're absolutely right, Jesse. He became far less known about in the 1990s and onwards, with a very, very different kind of economic situation in Aotearoa, New Zealand. But he became very well known because of his long-held communist beliefs during the Cold War, and his absolute commitment to class-based struggle as a concept in trade unions, but always with an eye to building the most unity you could around particular workers' issues, always connecting those outwards to how the capitalist system was creating those problems and issues, and unifying people in the trade union movement to do something about those issues.
And unification sounds like an obviously positive thing, but in fact there were plenty in different aspects of that struggle who didn't want to unify with each other.
Absolutely. Full of differences of opinions. Communists are great arguers. Absolutely fantastic arguers.
Yeah.
And for them, of course, it's all about the dialectic. So you need the arguments in order to come up with the best way forward.
Where does his story begin then?
So his story begins when he was born, I guess, on the 21st of January 1924. And I think what's really important to know about Bill is that he was the youngest child in a seafaring household.
Mm-hmm.
So his mother was New Zealand born, Minnie Bonham was her name, but his father was Danish, and he went to sea when he was a youngster, and jumped ship in New Zealand in 1902.
Wow.
And worked his way up through the seafaring hierarchy to become a master mariner. And so when he and Minnie had children, he was often away. So the family was very much largely raised by Minnie, and of course they all had a deep knowledge of the sea. And they were raised in Pāmua. And even though Bill Anderson was a child of the Depression, he was actually reasonably insulated from the ravages of, you know, some of the kinds of poverty that were going on for other working class people, particularly unemployed people, during this time, because his father was always in work all the way through the Depression. And I think that made a real difference. So he was very protected as a school child growing up. And so his memories of the 30s are quite carefree, about being sports loving, and you know, and he loved the fact that he ran around in bare feet. Right? It wasn't for him; it wasn't a hardship.
And I was going to ask you if his dad was very involved in the sort of the workers' rights struggle, but I imagine to be working at sea would be to be involved.
Well, no, not really. That's an interesting thing, because he was one of the officers, right? He was in charge on the ship. Yeah. So actually, Bill and he had rather differences of opinions. Bill would never go on to be further than an able seaman, because for him you never cross over from the working class.
Really?
Yeah.
Even given the opportunity?
Absolutely.
So would it be fair to call his parents left wing or not?
He wouldn't describe them as such. Interestingly, he described his father as anti-authoritarianism, which, given he was a master mariner, seems kind of interesting.
Mm.
But maybe in the fact that he didn't seem to mind so much when Bill got into trouble at school. He wasn't hardline about things like that. And he always talks about his mother as being incredibly kind and looking after people. So in that sense, he reflects on them. He doesn't talk about them as being the people that in any way mentored him into the kinds of working class struggles. That would come later for him during the war.
Yeah, I imagine, you know, when you get born in 1924, World War II is going to feature fairly prominently in your upbringing.
Yes, and I think that was really the overwhelming experience that led Bill to become a communist, was his experiences of the war. Now, he was the youngest child, remember, so his siblings had all joined the war effort in one way or another, as was his father. And so he left school in 1940. He was just 16 and joined the army. He only lasted 3 months. There are two stories about why he only lasted 3 months.
Yeah.
One of them is that they discovered he was indeed 16 and too young to be there. The other one is that he ran away to attend his sister's wedding. And so, because he went AWOL, got in terrible trouble and had to leave the army. So, I don't know, you can pick which one you want to believe.
Okay, but sometime over those few years he discovered Marx, right?
Yes, absolutely. So, he really doesn't go to see and discover Marx until after his mother dies very suddenly in 1941 of an asthma attack. And it really felt in that moment, I think, that Bill felt he had no home. Mm. And so that's what led him to join the Seafarers Union and to apply for a place as an able seaman on the sailing ship, the Finnish sailing ship, Pamir, that had just been captured by the New Zealand government. And held as a spoil of war. And so he was part of the first crew on the Pamir. And interestingly, they kept five of the original crew to sail the ship because they needed that experience. And Bill became very friendly with them and learnt to speak Swedish so that he could communicate with them. And, of course, one of them was Danish. So for him, I think it was very much about getting in touch with peoples that his father came from, right? And it's during this time that he started to enter his more troublemaking ways. So he helped hold up the ship due to poor living conditions for a while. And then, you know, clearly got a reputation on that sailing ship. By the time they got to San Francisco, Bill had an appendicitis anyway, so he was hospitalised for 2 weeks, but he was told under no certain terms was he welcomed back on that sailing ship. And so he was shipped home and spent the rest of the war shipping out as a merchant seaman on deep water ships. And his experiences on those ships that really deeply radicalised him, and not just on the ships, but also in his experiences in different ports, particularly in the Middle East. So it was pretty tough on those ships. Rations for able seamen were pretty poor. Conditions of where you were sleeping were incredibly cramped. And so, you know, you were hungry. And they were deeply hierarchical, the way ships were run, right? And so Bill really became quite radicalized by this kind of very obvious sign of a class system at work on a ship that seemed to him so terribly unfair. And he also, when he came into ports such as Aden, kind of British colonial ports, he was utterly horrified by the poverty he witnessed there amongst the dock workers, who to him looked like young children. And when he found out how little they were earning for the work they were doing and saw some of the poverty around the port where he was staying, he was so angered by the system he could see, because he was on these ships that were taking oil out of these incredibly oil-rich countries run by these British shipping companies, controlling these oil resources, and here were the indigenous peoples of these places living in the poverty that he was witnessing in port. And so he started to read Karl Marx, he started to read Lenin on board ship, and to make sense of the class relations that he was witnessing and what to do about this situation. And so that was really, and because ship's libraries are wonderful resources, he could get access to these texts and started to educate himself on some of the answers and why perhaps building a class struggle would be the way forward to do something about this capitalist system.
I'm speaking with Sibel Locke, who is the biographer of Bill Anderson. We're looking at his life today. He was a prominent communist and trade unionist in New Zealand and ended up being a thorn in the side of Sir Robert Muldoon. He must have arrived back in Auckland in 1946, a changed man then, Sibel.
He did. Glasses wearing, hardened seafaring communist who had learnt to use his fist to stand up for workers' rights on ships, had joined the Communist Party of Great Britain in Newcastle, and then came back and joined the Seafarers Union and went to sea in New Zealand waters, where he, of course, encountered Fintan Patrick Walsh, who was not only the president of the Seafarers Union, but also the vice president of the Federation of Labour, who was very supportive of the kind of stabilisation measures and the arbitration system to make the economy very controlled. Whilst Bill fell in with New Zealand communists, particularly seafarers, who were amongst workers who wanted to gain some of the rewards from this war that they've put so much effort towards. And, you know, to get better wages and better conditions for the work that they were doing, this hard work, seafaring.
Mm.
And so he joined the Communist Party in Auckland and met Communist Party leaders, Alec Drennan. Johnny Mitchell was particularly influential. He'd been a seaman as well. And these very pragmatic men who believed in the kind of communism that you'd gradually build the United Front by starting with where workers are at, what are the issues that they have in their lives, and working with them to build solidarity through their trade unions, increase active membership and democracy, and to come together and to use strikes to put pressure on employers to bring about those changes, all the while keeping the eye that it was the capitalist system that was the real problem. And whilst it was are really important to keep building solidarity, to push for a bigger slice of the cake for workers, it was also important to one day think about how you could build workers to reclaim the whole kitchen and to bring about a socialist New Zealand, but in very, very peaceful ways, right? I think the experience of the Second World War for someone like Bill meant that he was incredibly opposed to violence, right? Because, you know, you're on ships in the middle of the ocean, and these are huge convoys, there are blackouts. You never know when your ship is going to be blown out from under you. You know, it's that kind of incredible violence of the war left a lasting impression and meant that Bill was incredibly committed communist, but he always believed in trying to bring about peaceful socialist New Zealand.
And we're throwing the word communist around pretty lightly here, but I mean, after World War II in the US, there was a huge anti-communist movement, the Blacklist and so on. So
yes.
Were the same sorts of things happening here?
They were, but it was much milder, okay? So yes, people like communists were pushed out of leadership roles in the trade union movement by Fintan Patrick Walsh and others who supported him in different unions. This communist threat, they were part of this communist threat that was going on around the world, but in no way were they persecuted like they were in the United States. And Bill very quickly found a home after he was blacklisted from seafaring as part of this kind of anti-communist wave in the Waterside Workers Union amongst, you know, kind of where there was still very much a kind of a militant ethos to the leadership of that union, Jock Barnes and Toby Hill, who weren't at all communists, but they certainly believed in building militant trade unionism.
We should mention Bill's personal life as well. He met his wife at some stage in these years.
Absolutely. So he met her sailing in to Port Chalmers, and during the war, and they wrote letters to each other. And then after the war, she came up to visit, and they courted, and then they were married in 1948. And so, their first child was born during the 1951 waterfront dispute.
Huge dispute in New Zealand history. I'm keen to get on to Bill, some of his achievements in the 60s and 70s, but maybe just give people an idea of why that was such a big deal and the impact it had on him.
So this was kind of the watershed moment, really, of the kind of destruction of this kind of militant trade unionism that I talked about. So what the Waterside Workers Union claimed for a pay rise with employers, and rather than coming to negotiations, wouldn't come to negotiations, so they said, okay, we're going to refuse overtime until you negotiate with us. Rather than negotiate, the employers locked all watersiders out of the waterfront. And the national government came in and supported the employers and set an ultimatum for the watersiders. And when they said no, brought in regulations that deregistered the union, took funds. It became illegal to help watersiders in their efforts. And so this kind of five-month period of feeling like you're absolutely persecuted for your beliefs, you know. So Bill was part of the effort to get the watersiders' story published and out to the general population. But it was very, very difficult. And so it ended in defeat, right? So eventually the watersiders voted to go back to work, but by that stage they had no jobs left. So Bill was one of about 2,000 Auckland watersiders who were blacklisted from the waterfront forever. And so the lessons that Bill learnt from that time was never ever to become a militant minority in the trade union movement. That was where he learnt his lessons, that you always build slowly your organisation, and that you can use stop work meetings and strikes to push for better wages and conditions and to push for certain things, but never to go beyond the strength of your organisation and always to carry all your members with you.
Mm.
And so that was what figured in the 50s and 60s, that this slow building of working class solidarity across unions. And he worked inside the Northern Drivers Union, which was had a large Māori membership, some say about half the union, some would argue even three-quarters of the membership. And so they brought particular ways of working together and solidarity, and so they did a lot of anti-racism work. They were very clear that there was the colour bar occurring in New Zealand in the 50s. They had anti-racism policy about that. So union organisers would be going in and challenging racism by employers against Māori workers. And they also got involved in linking up with efforts around the Ban the Bomb movement, campaign for nuclear disarmament, leading the Southern Hemisphere nuclear-free ban peace petition.
In fact, one of the only issues missing from this list is the gender issue, because it was quite a blokey sort of an organisation, right?
Absolutely. So by the 70s, about 2% of drivers across the country were women. So there were delegates, women delegates, who did come in the 1970s, and eventually one of the organisers was a woman. But yes, absolutely. The kinds of unions where Bill was operating were very much male-dominated organisations that he was working amongst. So yes, absolutely. Whilst he was to open, the drivers' union had equal pay as its policy from the very beginning, but as Ken Douglas explained to me, this was very much because drivers never expected that women would be driving trucks.
It's got a nice message, you know, where we're talking about communism and the sense that they were being watched. This texter has just got in touch. Says, I went to Bill's house when he lived in Avondale. I was a telecom faultman at the time. We chatted and he asked me if I was doing any extra work on his phone. I laughed and said I didn't think so, and told him that my cousin was a communist, and so Bill relaxed quite a bit, and we chatted all afternoon about issues at the time for the working class. So what was let's talk politics. What was Bill's relationship with the Labour Party, and let's make sure we talk about his relationship with Robert Muldoon as well.
Absolutely. So the Communist Party tried very hard to form a kind of united front relationship with the Labour Party, but the Labour Party wouldn't have a bar of it. Bill was amongst a group of trade unionists who left the Communist Party and formed the Socialist Unity Party in 1966, when the Communist Party decided to change their allegiance to China and to be far more radical and to be much more, to really challenge the Labour Party and to be much more ultra-left-wing in its line and more revolutionary. Mm. So Bill was part of a group of trade union communists who said, no, we don't want to have a bar over that. We want to continue this kind of united front approach and to build relationships with left people in the Labour Party.
He stood for Parliament against Muldoon and Tamaki. Was he a Labour candidate or an independent?
No, Socialist Unity Party. So he stood, in four elections, 1972 through to 1981, in the Tamaki electorate against Muldoon.
There would have been some good debates.
Hugely good debates. I mean, he's very well known during this time because in televised debates with Muldoon. See, now, Bill was a very softly spoken, very, very calm, kind of rational speaker. And for some reason, that drove Muldoon crazy. Bill won lots of respect from working class people because he stood up to Muldoon's anti-unionism and anti-communism. Was deeply supportive of what Ngāti Whātua Ōrākei were doing at Bastion Point as well. So what the Air New Zealand staff used to do sometimes is put them on the plane next to each other to see what would happen.
Really?
And so, you know, Muldoon would reach across and say, now, Bill, you didn't get very many votes standing against me in Tamaki, did you? And then Bill would quietly smile and he'd look at Muldoon and he'd say, well, if you come and stand for Secretary of the Northern Drivers' Union, shall we see how many votes you get there?
He did have a few wins against Muldoon, right? Not electoral wins, but in some of those Labour disputes.
He did come off very well in some of the Labour disputes in the late 70s. And I think kind of that building of cross-union solidarity in Auckland was incredibly effective. And using both kind of militants, stop work and strike actions, as well as negotiating through the arbitration system with this dual approach, and managed to build up enough cross-union solidarity to actually force to first of all produce New Zealand's first ever national general strike in 1979, and also to push to change the law, the Remuneration Act, that had been used to really clamp down on the wage rises that working class people were beginning to gain during that period. But that was a win.
Yeah. But lest we think that Bill and his unions were the people's heroes, actually public opposition to trade unions was starting to grow around that stage.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things we need to keep in our minds is that we had growing unemployment during this time. You know, in the 50s and 60s, remarkable for how little unemployment there was in this country. And there was a deep commitment to having full employment. But across the 70s, for a whole range of reasons, we have steadily increasing unemployment, and it affected working class people first. But it was building up enough that it was really threatening, trade union power, right? Because members were being lost to unemployment, and it was beginning to haunt people, and so people were going, well, I don't want to lose my job if I go on get involved in this strike. And so because of those range of issues, I think, there was kind of growing backlash, and it's in those circumstances that Muldoon then put in place the wage freeze, which meant that trade unions could no longer negotiate any wage rises, and also then abolished compulsory unionism, which has been a way of really safeguarding the membership of private sector trade unions up until this period. And kind of the economic devastation caused by that wage freeze, you know, was faced by the Fourth Labour government in 1984, who then decide to put in these incredibly drastic economic reforms.
Yeah, what did he make of that? He finally got his Labour government.
Well, absolutely.
I guess he had one in the mid-70s too, didn't he? But he would have been hopeful for, you know, for a big change post-Muldoon. Well, there were big changes, but maybe not the sorts of ones he'd anticipated.
Yeah, I think he was deeply shocked. But one of his big regrets that he talks a bit about later was how much of a fair go he gave the Labour Party during this time, that because of the kind of the anti-nuclear stuff, stuff around Treaty of Waitangi, Waitangi Tribunal, rights for Māori, all sorts of great social policies that were happening at the same time. It was hoped that, you know, if we just keep kind of supporting Labour on the good things they're doing, but saying, hey, hang on a minute, and working through to try and get them to change away from this kind of economic agenda that's hurting us so badly. But they didn't have any success there. And what happened was, as you had protections lifted and the domestic economy starting to crash, you had closures, you had increasing numbers of redundancies, whittling away thousands of private sector workers, and then as the state sector acts and the privatisation, state-owned enterprises coming in, and loads of white-collar jobs going as well, you had this kind of incredibly tough time. And, of course, all the while losing kind of your labour power through redundancies and growing unemployment.
Did he stay, we're just about out of time, did he stay politically active in his final years? I mean, he didn't die till 2005. What would that have made him, 81 or something?
Yes, so he stayed building the Northern Drivers Union, came together with the Storsham Packers, retail workers, to form the Northern Distribution Union and then the National Distribution Union, and kind of continuing to amalgamate with clothing workers, with wood industry workers, to kind of shore up and keep this kind of collective voice for workers, and to keep this kind of struggle-based approach to trade unionism alive. And that union, First Union, is still with us and very healthy to this day and doing some great work out there.
His funeral must have been a big moment.
A huge moment by all accounts. There was a memorial up at Bastion Point, and yeah, where people gathered from all walks of life.
Cabinet ministers, mayors, councillors, and of course his beloved workers. Sibel, thank you so much for giving us a bit of an idea of what Bill Anderson's life looked like.
My pleasure.
Yeah, nice to chat to you. Sibel Locke, biographer, talking about the life of trade unionist and communist Bill Anderson.